everybody. Welcome to episode 692 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is our new Comics Wednesday episode for January 23rd, 2019. So many good books coming out today. Kind of had a hard time narrowing it down to what I wanted to talk about. So I'm going to be talking about quite a few books. Let's see, 2, 4, 6, 8, 9 books I'm going to mention. Some of them I'm going to talk about a little more in detail than others. For example, I do want to speak briefly about Justice League number 16, but we're going to cover it more in depth in our Justice League spotlight. So I won't get too in depth on that, but I do want to mention it just because it's such an important issue and it's really good, and I want to make sure you guys are picking it up. So some of the titles, like I said, I'll talk about a little more than others. But I just had a hard time narrowing it down, and I actually did narrow it down from like 13 or 14 down to just these 9. But let me go ahead and get started with Hardcore, issue number 2. It's written by Andy Diggle. We have art by Alessandro Vitti. We have colors by Adriano Lucas. Letters by Thomas Maurer. And a really great cover by Dan Panosian. Actually, Dan did the cover for issue 1 as well. So this is from a concept created by Robert Kirkman and Mark Silvestri, and it basically gives the main character the ability to sort of jack in to other people. They basically shoot them with this nearly microscopic dart, which allows our user to basically kind of take over, like remote control the body, and it makes for perfect assassins because that microscopic dart, it like decays, it basically disintegrates, and there's no evidence left. So you can assassinate people or get to people that you normally would never be able to get to under ordinary circumstances. And we saw at the end of issue 1 that the guy that had kind of helped create this program and help create the technology, he was coming back for some revenge. He got forced out. He clearly wasn't psychologically stable, and he got forced out, and he did not like that. And so he's back to try to take over and steal the program from the American government, from the American military complex. And that's kind of where issue number 1 ends, with our main character kind of being up a creek and not having any ability to get out of the body that he's in. He's literally trapped in the sphere where he jacks into bodies, and he's trapped in the body of this colonel in some, I think it's a Central American country, and he basically like works security for a drug lord, and his name's Esteban. And so that's the situation he finds himself in. And it's pretty interesting. This concept is kind of a mashup of a lot of different things, right? There was that TV show back in the late 90s or early 2000s where we saw a guy that was jumping around through time, and it was kind of the same thing. He was in a pod, and he would go through time. So it kind of reminds me of that in a way. And then it kind of reminds me of Free Jack in a way, if you guys remember that Emilio Estevez movie that had Mick Jagger and Anthony Hopkins and Rene Russo, which was actually pretty good, especially for considering the time period it was. Free Jack, it was called. So that was cool as well. So again, it's a mashup of a lot of different ideas, and it's fast-paced action. I like the voice that Andy Diggle is giving to Drake, who's kind of our main guy. He's the one that basically goes and jacks in, takes over and remote controls these other bodies. And issue 1 was not a whole lot of setup. The action took off pretty fast, and we got just enough exposition to kind of understand what's going on. And then the same thing with issue 2. There's a little bit of exposition in terms of reminding everybody of who the players are, but it's mostly all action. And, you know, we can tell Drake is really capable. The guy that he's in, Esteban, whose body he's in, is fairly capable as well. as opposed to, like, in the first issue we saw that Drake was complaining that the guy that he had been downloaded into or was controlling was out of shape and, you know, overweight, and it made his job a lot easier. So at least he's working with a body now that's a lot more physically fit. So that allows him to do more. And it's clear that Marcus, the guy who has kind of hijacked the programs, taken over, has plans in place to be able to not just seize control of the hardcore program, but be able to somehow keep it, because he does seem to have quite an army at his disposal, and they're out doing other nefarious things besides just hijacking the hardcore program. So again, it's an interesting title. It's a fun title. The art by Alessandro Vitti is very visceral. It's not quite, I could swear that I've seen his art a little tighter than this before. It's a little loose, and it's not always sketchy, but there are certain panels where it seems a little looser than I've seen it in the past. But it kind of works for the story, because this is sort of a messy story, right? It's not, this isn't, you know, by the numbers with things going as Drake expects, and he's kind of having to make things up as he goes along based on the situation that he's being put in, where he's trapped inside this, you know, the hardcore tube or sphere or whatever you want to call it, the hardcore system. And, you know, Marcus is about to try to cut him out, and he's on the run. You know, his body is there in the same facility Marcus is in, but technically he's 4,000 miles away. And what can he do from there? How can he, you know, save himself? How can he save the program? How can he defeat Marcus? And he still has to convince everybody that's around him that he is Esteban. So there's a lot of moving parts here, and it's not a paint by numbers, or he doesn't have the option of the luxury of kind of making a plan and sticking to it. He's improvising on the fly. So a lot of action, really fast paced. The issue was over before I knew it, and I can't wait for the next issue. This has been two issues in. This has been a really wild ride with some fun twists and turns. So next issue is not out till the end of February. I have to wait till the 27th of February to pick it up, but I definitely will be picking it up. It's been a really fun ride so far. Last thing I'll mention is the color work by Adriano Lucas. You know, I've been a fan of Adriano for a long time. His work on the Thief of Thieves title has been exemplary, and it's the same here. This is more of a realistic story, right? It's not superheroes. It's not fantasy. It's more gritty. It's more down to earth, and his color choices and his color palette kind of reflect that. They're pretty muted. There's not a lot of bright colors until we get to the explosions. Things blow up. They tend to get a little bright. But other than that, it's more of a muted palette, which, as I said, really suits the story that Andy Diggle is telling. So hats off to Adriano as well. All right, next up, I'm going to talk about Wildstorm, chapter number 19. It's from writer Warren Ellis. We have art by John Davis Hunt, colors by Steve Buccioletto, and letters by Simon Boland. Five issues to go, four after this one. Right there on the cover, we know that this was always planned to be a 24-issue story for the Wildstorm. And I know, and I think I've talked about this on the past when I've covered Wildstorm issues, I know that some people have not been enjoying this version of Wildstorm. It's too different for them from the superhero universe that Jim Lee created way back when. But for me, you know, I never read a ton of that old Wildstorm stuff. So for me, this is interesting. I'm not comparing it to the old stuff. I'm not bringing a lot of baggage or knowledge or history of the old classic Wildstorm to this, and so I'm just enjoying it for what it is. And what it is a really fun conspiracy theory, sort of pseudo superhero science fiction tale. in the way that only Warren Ellis can tell it. So this issue 19 has shades and echoes of The Authority, which I know was a groundbreaking series back when. You know, we see Jenny Sparks, we see Angela Spica, we see, you've got Jack Hawksmoor, you've got the Doctor. So clearly there is some real reverberations of The Authority. Now, again, this isn't a story where it's a retelling or reimagining of the Wildstorm universe as Jim Lee saw it. It's really Warren Ellis taking only the highest ideas, the highest of concepts, and creating a completely new story all on his own. So, again, I really like it. I understand why some people might not, if they have a lot of nostalgia for the original Wildstorm universe. But if you can just take this for what it is, take this as it stands on its own, it's really great. And one other thing I should mention is there's a couple of other characters, Wildstorm characters, that show up here that have a big following that people might want to check it out purely on the basis of them showing up. And that is Midnighter and Apollo showing up, still both male, still both homosexual, still both very much in love. So I'm really digging the Wildstorm title. It's one of those books that I think that I'll go back to again and again, and probably, you know, once it's all finished and all the issues have come out, I'm sure I'll go back and read 1 through 24 in one sitting, and I'll probably even revisit the title periodically. I really do think it's that good, and not only narratively but also art-wise. I think John Davis Hunt, the only reason more people don't know his name and people aren't clamoring for him to do, I think he'd be incredible on Batman. Justice League would be another title I think he'd be really good on. And I think the reason people aren't talking about him is because I don't know that this title is really on a lot of people's radar. And the only other work that I know that John Davis Hunt has done was some work with Gail Simone on her Clean Room series, which was another title over at DC. It was actually at Vertigo. So again, I just don't know that many people have seen his work, because I have to think with his level of detail, with his layouts, his and not panel layouts. He's pretty traditional when it comes to the layouts of panel on the page, but the way he lays out characters within the panel, his sense of storytelling is all top notch. His line work is excellent, especially good at body language and facial expressions. So I think he's, as soon as he gets on something big, like if he did an issue of Batman or Justice League, you know, something with Scott Snyder, maybe something with Tom King, all of a sudden everybody would be like, oh my God, this is an incredibly talented artist. You know, I love DC, and as much as I wouldn't want to see John Davis Hunt go on to a title that I'm not particularly interested in, I mean, I would follow him anywhere, but it's this kind of talent that DC has on a book that's not on everybody's radar that makes me go, man, why doesn't Marvel, how come Marvel can't keep up these days with artists? How come they're hurting? Because Spider-Man would be another incredible book to see John Davis Hunt on. Avengers, so many titles, maybe some of the Infinity stuff, the cosmic stuff over at Marvel would be great for John Davis to do. I mean, sky's the limit. I think this guy can do anything. He's incredibly talented. And I don't know. I mean, I really am enjoying the Wildstorm story. But again, I think, and Davis Hunt has been on it since the beginning, I don't know that I would have enjoyed it as much with another artist on it. And he's, you know, sometimes when you don't have an artist do a particularly long run on a book, or the artist changes, you know, issue after issue after issue for, you know, 3 or 4 issues in a row, it really forces the writing to really carry more than its fair share of the burden of making the book interesting. And I think a lot of times those are the books that struggle, because there's no consistency there. And especially if there are one or two of those artists that you don't really care for their style, right? So I don't know if a different artist on the Wildstorm would have me enjoying it as much as I have been. But that's the great thing about it. I don't even have to speculate. It's been John Davis Hunt the whole time. It will be John Davis Hunt the whole time. And I love that. I love that this is going to be in a trade or a hardback at some point with only his art. And I get to just enjoy it for what it is. And I never have to think about, I wonder what it would have looked like. I wonder if it would have lost momentum or whatever, right? It's just good, solid comic art with great body language, like I said, great facial expressions, a lot of emotion, and some really, really cool action scenes. So I think it's a really underrated title. I haven't heard a lot of people talking about The Wildstorm. And so I hope there are people out there that are picking it up and enjoying it as much as I am. All right, on to the next title that I'm going to talk about. It's Shazam number 2. It's from writer Jeff Johns with art by Marco Santucci, colors by Mike Atea, and letters by Rob Lee. We have a cover by Dale Eaglesham and Alex Sinclair, a variant cover by Chris Samney and Matt Wilson. Now, this is kind of one of those situations I was just talking about. Dale Eaglesham is supposed to be the regular artist on this Shazam book. When Jeff Johns was doing the backup Shazam stories in Justice League, when the New 52 came out, he was working with Gary Frank. Well, obviously, him and Gary are really busy on the Doomsday Clock story right now, so Gary Frank wasn't available for this, so they said, okay, we'll pull in Dale Eaglesham. Now, Dale Eaglesham is not... It's not like a poor man's substitute for Gary Frank, right? It's not like, okay, we couldn't get Gary Frank, so we'll get this substitute that's not as good. Dale Eaglesham's art is just as detailed as Gary Frank. Super clean, super vibrant, great backgrounds. I mean, the guy is an incredible talent. I really enjoyed his work on the Secret Six book that he did recently in New 52 with Gail Simone. That just shows the level of artistry and talent that this guy has. And so when I heard he was doing the book, I was really excited. And then we come to issue 2, and we already have a different artist on the book. So I know Dale is solicited to do the art for issue 3, so I hope he's coming back. I think I saw the other day that Jeff Johns posted a crazy picture for a double page spread from issue 3 that was Dale Eaglesham. So hopefully he's coming back. Maybe he just got sick, needed an issue off or whatever. But this is a monthly title, so it's not like it's the bi-weekly situation where you have to have two artists working on the book. But I hope that Jeff Johns and Dale Eaglesham can get into somewhat of a rhythm. And we're able to get on track here, because the other thing about issue 2 was it shipped a month late. It's got a Christmas cover, like Santa Claus and Shazam and the rest of the Shazam family basically look like they're helping Santa deliver presents. But it came out in January. Like, it's coming out January 23rd, you know, not even like the first week of January, but late into January. So that's never a great thing when a book ships late, but especially when it has kind of a cover that's sort of time sensitive like that. So again, I'm not sure what the deal was, why Dale wasn't able to draw it, but I hope everything's okay, and I hope Dale is able to stay on the book, and that we get more incredible work from him in subsequent issues. All that being said, I think that the artist they did get for the issue is no slouch himself, Marco Santucci. I think he does a pretty good job. His art is nowhere as detailed as Dale Eaglesham's art or Gary Frank's art, for that matter. But I think he does a pretty good job. He's a little light on the backgrounds in certain panels, but for the most part, it's standard panel layouts, and layouts within those panels are pretty standard as well. But he does have a good sense of storytelling, and the comic does have a great flow. As far as the story itself, Jeff Johns just seems to have this knack of telling stories that feel very classic, like they would fit into just about any era of the DC universe. And it would have that DC feel. I don't know what it is that this guy has, but, you know, if this was back in the 80s, it would feel appropriate. It's in the 2000s. It feels appropriate. It's pretty incredible what he's able to do, especially for a character as classic as Shazam or Captain Marvel. So Geoff Johns has a pretty big following. At this point, I wish that he was writing more books. I think he's just doing this Shazam title and the Doomsday Clock title. And being that this one was late and Doomsday has gone bi-monthly, we just, in my opinion, don't have enough Geoff Johns on the stands. We know he did move on from his role as Chief Creative Officer at DC, so I don't know if that's going to free up more time for him to write. I think it's supposed to. I think that his role over in the DC Extended Universe, the movie part of the DC Universe, I think that role was reduced as well. So, again, if that affords him more time to write comics, then I think that's a great thing. I don't know that that's his necessarily his first love. I know he went to school to be a filmmaker, so that may be where his true passion lies. But the guy's been an incredible comic artist for quite some time. And I think he has a lot of great stories yet to tell. And I hope that he can balance everything that he's trying to do. And we can get these books to come out a little quicker, because his books sell. His books get people excited. His books get people into comic shops. They get people reading their titles. So that's a good thing. If it's bringing back lapsed readers, if it's reaching new readers, I think it's a good thing for the comics industry in general. So if you have somebody who is looking for something that feels classic, you can definitely point them in the direction of Shazam. It's definitely a title I recommend. And as I said, I believe Dale Eaglesham is coming back on art for the next issue. So look for that, and I'm sure I'll be covering that next issue on the podcast as well. First two issues have been great, and I'm really looking forward to Geoff Johns spending more time with these characters and us learning kind of more about this Shazam family. What does it mean for the greater DC universe? Because, you know, Geoff Johns is always going to tell stories that have ramifications beyond just the pages of the story that he's telling. If I have any nitpick at all, it's that I wouldn't mind if the pacing picked up a little bit. But again, that's probably just because, you know, we got the first issue and then it took almost 2 months for the next issue to come out. So it just makes it seem like the story is moving along a little slower than I would like it to. So that's just a selfish nitpick on my part, just because I want, you know, more of this Shazam story. All right, next book I'm going to talk about is Naomi. It's from writers Brian Michael Bendis and David F. Walker. We have art and colors, inks, all that by Jamal Campbell, who, if you've never seen Jamal Campbell's art, man, you are in for a treat. His art is absolutely spectacular. In a way, it reminds me a little bit of Adam Hughes. It has this kind of this sheen, this polish to it, but it's much more dynamic than Hughes' art. I mean, you can see it right from the start. You get to second and third pages is a double page spread of Superman fighting Mongol, and it's just absolutely incredible. So as far as the story itself, this is a new character that's been created by the trio of Campbell, Bendis, and Walker. She's an African-American girl. And she seems to be obsessed with Superman in a way. But there's a scene in the first issue where she's talking to somebody and they make the very astute observation that it might not be necessarily that she thinks she's Superman or wants to be Superman or wants to, you know, feel that powerful. It's more about the fact that Naomi's adopted and she knows on some level that Superman is adopted as well. That he's an orphan. He came to this planet from another world and turned out to be very special. And I think that a lot of people who are adopted, I think that they, especially young children, you know, they kind of harbor that in the back of their mind that they maybe they don't know what their true origins are. They want to know what their origins are. They think, well, you know, maybe it's possible that I am special too, that I have powers too. You know, I don't know where I came from. And I don't even think that that's necessarily a concept that is exclusive to people that are adopted. I think a lot of kids think that at various times of their life, when they're growing up, when they're facing hardships, they think, wouldn't it be great if I found out I was, you know, secretly a prince, or secretly a princess, or somebody important, or somebody who has magical powers? You know, it's a pretty common thing for kids to think. And so in that way, it makes this character of Naomi very relatable. And I think that's the part about the story that I enjoyed the most, was just how down to earth the story is, just how realistic these characters seem. The voices that Bendis and Walker have given them, the body language and the way they interact with each other, and the way that Jamal Campbell has rendered them also comes across as very realistic. This takes place in a small town where supposedly nothing ever happens. They kind of hammer that point home. Nothing exciting ever happens here. And so for Superman to have shown up in a fight with Mongol in this small town, and the fight lasted only like 17 seconds, it's a big deal. And it sort of sends Naomi down this path of discovery, of reminding her that she wants to find out who she is. And I have a feeling who she is may turn out to be somebody special after all. So, again, I think this is a can't-miss book. I love the voice that the writers gave to Naomi. I love the look that Jamal Campbell gave her. She looks very realistic, very down-to-earth. I don't know how many 16- or 17-year-old African-American girls or young women are reading comics, but I'll say this, we need more of them reading comics, because we need more of young people in general reading comics. We really need the next generation of readers to be a little larger than the previous generation if we want the industry to continue to be able to put out the amount of material it's putting out now, which I've said many times, I feel like we're in a golden age of comics when it comes to content. And it's just a matter of reaching those new readers, and digital has a lot to do with that. But it's great to see a character like Naomi, you know, 16, 17-year-old African-American female leading her own book. And I would challenge anybody who says, oh, this is tokenism, or this is diversity for diversity's sake. No, not at all. This is Brian Michael Bendis and David F. Walker and Jamal Campbell telling a story about a girl that on some level they can relate to. You know, both Walker and Campbell are African-American themselves. And, you know, look what Bendis did with Miles Morales. He created a new version of Spider-Man that was mixed race and that was a person of color, and eventually ended up on the big screen with an incredible animated movie that's nominated to win an Academy Award. So don't sit there and tell me that just because the lead character of this book is female and African American, that it's not going to work, or that they're just doing it to be politically correct, or, you know, they're all trying to advance their liberal agenda. No, it's not about that at all. It's about telling a good story. It's about having the stories in comics that are representative of the world that we all live in. You know, there's all kinds of races, there's all kinds of colors, there's all kinds of people out there in the world. And again, we need to grow readership. So that means it's got to be a quality story. And the other thing you can do to grow readership is you can have the comics contain characters that people can relate to, right? You want younger readers reading more comics, then you've got to put young characters in the comics that have voices that sound authentic to those readers, so they have something to identify with. It's something that we all want. We all want to feel a part of something. We all want to feel like we can relate to things. And I feel like Bendis, Walker, and Campbell have done a tremendous job of that in this first issue. Again, it's Naomi. It's a character who's a young African-American woman, and yet me, as a straight, married, aged guy, white, I found myself relating to her. There's parts of her story that I could relate to. So the package doesn't necessarily matter if you can find a touchstone where you can relate to her. But the package does matter in terms of maybe that becomes someone's touchstone, right? Maybe someone will relate to Naomi because, hey, I look like her, or she looks like me, or I'm adopted, or whatever it might be, right? So telling these kind of stories with diverse characters, I think, is important. And then when you tell the story with the quality of scripting and pacing that Bendis and Walker have brought to the title, then that's, you know, another reason to pick it up. And then you add Campbell's art on top of that, and yeah, you have a real winner here. I would not be surprised to see this book shoot up in price. I think a lot of people would love to have gone back and picked up the first appearance of Miles Morales, because that's the one character that I keep going back to, because it's the most recent kind of person of color, interesting character, diverse character you could relate to, that felt both down to earth and yet heroic, that Bendis has created. And so I can't help but compare the two. And so you want to be sure you get out and pick up this book tomorrow, because I could see this one being sought after pretty quickly, because even if it's not picked up tomorrow by the majority of people, it's not going to take long. Comics is a very word of mouth sort of industry. And the people that do pick it up and read it are going to be telling their friends that didn't pick it up, hey, you need to go out and pick this up. And before you know it, there's going to be a big demand. And I just don't know how big the print run's going to be. So do yourself a favor and make sure you get yourself a copy tomorrow. You won't regret it in terms of value down the line. And I don't think you'll regret it either in terms of storytelling. This is my book of the week, without question. I thought it was absolutely incredible. And yeah, the fact that Superman showed up, even if it was only for a few panels, doesn't hurt, right? Always a sucker for Superman. So yeah, it was absolutely incredible. Blew me away. Was totally impressed. Kudos to the entire creative team. All right, speaking of great creative teams, the next book I'm going to talk about is Freedom Fighters number 2. It's from writer Robert Venditti, pencils by Eddie Barrows, inks by Eber Ferreira, colors by Adriano Lucas, and letters by Darren Bennett. I'm going to talk about the colors first. I already talked about Adriano Lucas doing incredible color work on Hardcore, and now I'm going to talk about incredible color work that he did on this book. There are a lot of explosions. This book, this issue, is nonstop action from start to finish, and the explosions are suitably bright. They really leap off the page. But there's one page in particular where I was reading it and I literally turned to that page and I said out loud, "Wow." And you know, I'll give credit to Eddie Barrows and Eber Ferreira as well, the rest of the art team, because the image is just amazing. But I it was especially the color work that really made it pop from Adriano Lucas. It's basically a giant robot blowing up, and it blew me away. I'm not even kidding. I'm not exaggerating. I turned the page and said out loud, "Wow." I mean, it's that amazing. It's at this point, and I know we're just getting started this year, but at this point, it is without question my favorite comic page, favorite comic panel of the year. It just was absolutely incredible. And so I had to give a shout out to Adriano Lucas for doing an incredible job. As far as the story itself, you know, Robert Venditti is one of my favorite writers. He was my writer of the year for last year. Having him tell a story about an Earth where the Nazis won, I think is a great choice, because I think he understands the classic field that these freedom fighter characters have, and that even if you bring them into a more modern setting like he's done, it does have somewhat of a classic feel because the Nazis won. And the Nazis aren't necessarily about advancement, right? About, I mean, they want the most advanced weapons for themselves, but they're not about, you know, evolution and education and moving the vast majority of civilization, of their society forward, right? They don't want the people thinking. They want the people beaten down and downtrodden. And that's just a way that they think that they can maintain control. So in a way, even though this is set in modern times, because the Nazis won, the Earth feels a little more old-fashioned, if you know what I'm saying. So Venditti does a great job of making this new team of freedom fighters feel classic. I think it's only a matter of time before we see Uncle Sam show up. We've got 10 issues left, and I imagine that Robert Venditti has it paced out to where he knows, you know, exactly what's going to happen in each one of the issues, and he's just kind of dividing it up. But I will say that this issue was so fast-paced, and it was, as I said, action from start to finish, that it was over all too soon. And I was like, no, please, it cannot be over already. I need more. I need the next issue right now, or just a couple more pages. Just give me a couple more pages. So that being said, I do recommend picking it up. It's a lot of fun. I think that the story is going to read great in trade. And I'd love to see it actually last past 12 issues, because based on what I've seen so far, it looks like it could. But in Venditti, I trust. I'm sure he'll give us a satisfying story with these 12 issues. And the entire creative team. I mean, Eddie Barrows, I think, is a bit of an underrated artist as well. Puts a lot of detail into his art. I love his panel layouts, especially on his double page spreads. He uses a lot of insets that work really well. Does a great job of leading your eye around the page with the way he lays the panels out. And yeah, this is just fun comics. Really great pacing. And like I said, the best comic book page I've seen this year with that explosion. So definitely pick up Freedom Fighters. It's been really great. I pretty much everybody that I've talked to that's picked it up loved the first issue. So I expect to hear more of the same tomorrow with issue two. All right, next up, speaking of Robert Venditti, we actually have another book from him that's out tomorrow. It's Damage, number 13. And we know that Damage has been canceled. I think issue 16, I want to say, is going to be the last issue. So that's unfortunate, because I think this title has been a whole heck of a lot of fun, too. His co-storyteller is Aaron Lopresti, who handles the art. Inks are by Matt Ryan. Colors are by Hi-Fi, with letters by Tom Napolitano. And one of the really fun things that we've had in the Damage series so far is some incredible fights, which is why I was so excited when Aaron Lopresti came on board, because he handles action and brawling just about better than anyone. And I know he's having an absolute blast. He told me so himself, working on this title. So a couple issues ago, we got to see Damage go head-to-head with Superman. And not to be outdone, in this issue, we get to see him go head-to-head with Batman. But unfortunately for Damage, things are not quite what they seem. And Batman is, although he may be outmatched physically, you know, in a straight one-on-one matchup, it would be pretty tough for him to go head-to-head with Damage just based on power levels. But it's Batman, you know, he's always got a plan. He's always planned ahead. And things don't end up turning out too well for Damage in the long run. But it's a really fun issue. I can easily see Robert Venditti wrapping up this story in the next 3 or 4 issues. It seems like it's on pace to do so. But we did see Damage captured last issue, and we saw him being treated in the Hall of Justice, Ethan Avery being treated in the Hall of Justice. And I have to say that as much as I'm loving what Scott Snyder is doing in Justice League right now, and I know there's not really room for it right now just because of how epic and huge in scope the story is that he's telling, there is one thing that does keep his Justice League from feeling 100% classic, and that is having a young junior member. Some of the best eras of Justice League have had those junior members that were trying to learn the ropes, whether that be Red Tornado or Firestorm or Gypsy. And so I definitely would not mind seeing Damage join Justice League, if only for a while, you know, maybe a year, 10, 12 issues, just to kind of see him. First of all, to be able to see him, because as I said, his title's canceled, so would love to see him show up somewhere. And the other thing, it just gives a different dynamic for the older heroes to be a mentor and to give advice and teach somebody how to be a hero. It can be a great story device. So yeah, don't really know how it would fit in right now necessarily, just because of the story that Scott Snyder's telling, but I wouldn't mind seeing that in the long run. As far as the art goes, as I said, Aaron Lopresti, incredible job when he depicts brawls, and there's no exception here. I mean, the fight between Damage and Batman is suitably epic. It's a whole lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to Aaron getting a chance to really spread his wings on the next issue that's coming out, because based on what happens kind of on the last page, last few pages, last two or three pages of this issue, it looks like Aaron's going to really have his hands full and be able to do some really, really cool stuff. So yeah, I think that enough people have been reading Damage, and that's probably why it got canceled. And it's really too bad, because I think it's been a quality book. And that's probably always going to be the case. That's always going to be my opinion when Robert Venditti's writing, because again, I think he's just an incredible writer. He always, kind of like Tom King does, he always throws at least one or two funny lines at every book. And it's no exception here when Batman's fighting Damage. And I don't want to give away what he says, but it's the panel where Batman's throwing the grenade at Damage. That line is classic. So if you do pick it up, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. All right, on to the next book that I'm going to mention. It's Justice League number 16 from writers Scott Snyder and James Tynan IV. We've got Tynan scripting, Jim Chung and Steven Segovia on pencils, Chung, Morales, and Segovia on inks, with Tomeu Morey and Will Quintana handling the colors, and Tom Napolitano on the letters. And I mentioned this one at the top of the show, but I'm not going to go into a whole heck of a lot of detail on it, just because we will cover it in depth in a Justice League Spotlight episode coming up in probably next week. But what I do want to mention is that this issue gives us a lot of answers into some clues about who Perpetua is, some clues about the symbol that we see on that doorknob that Lex Luthor has been wielding, and also some answers into how John Jones fits into the larger story. We did see John kind of make the call in the first issue of Justice League. And in a way, this issue sort of ties all the way back into that decision that John made, and gives some more context into it and gives that decision a little more weight in a way. The other thing that's really great about this issue, any fans of Starman, the Will Patton Starman, he makes an appearance in this issue beyond just being shown in a bed in kind of a comatose state. So it's really kind of cool the way Tynan and Snyder are using him. So, there's possibilities for Starman to be a pretty important figure in the DC universe going forward, just based on kind of the power level that Snyder and Tynan have given him here. So that's intriguing to me as well. So again, I could say a lot more, but I'll save it for the spotlight. The only way this issue could have been better, in my opinion, has been one of the best issues of Justice League so far. It was absolutely spectacular. The only way it could have been better is with a Jaro appearance, which we sadly did not get. So, all right, on to the next title I'm going to mention. It's Batman number 63 from writer Tom King. We have art by Mikhail Yanin, colors by Jordi Belair, and letters by Clayton Cowles. It's continuing the Nightmares storyline. This is part 3, Smoke and Mirrors. We have Constantine guest starring, and I love that we have Constantine guest starring because, as many of you may or may not know, Constantine was in Justice League Dark when Mikhail Yanin was the artist on that title. And for my money, I don't know that anybody draws John Constantine better than Mikhail Yanin. And I know there's other artists who draw him that make him look a little more like Sting or a little less like Sting, than more disheveled, less disheveled. Yanin doesn't draw him quite so beat down by life as I've seen other artists depict John. And he's a little more suave. He's a little more kind of debonair. And I kind of like that. I kind of like that he's a little more stylish. To me, it gives him a little more flair. You know, he's got a little bit more of that James Bond British kind of air about him. And for whatever reason, I like that version of Constantine. He's still rumpled. He's still disheveled. But for whatever reason, I really like the way Mikhail Yanin renders Constantine. As far as the story goes, you know, it's been pretty clear ever since I think it was issue 62, the Professor Pig story, that there is something going on with Batman that we're just not understanding. This issue, we finally get some clues about just what might be going on. And we also get an idea that despite the fact that Batman could be in big trouble, and whoever it is that's putting him through this situation, that's giving him these nightmares, they've once again underestimated him. You can't really stop the will and determination of Batman. You can put him in a trap. You can tie him down. You can do whatever. He's convinced that he's always going to win. And so for that reason, he never gives up. And I think that ultimately that will be the way he gets out of this. In the meantime, what we're getting is Tom King getting to comment on who Batman is as a character. And not just who he is as you know, a character and a hero in terms of Bruce Wayne, but who he is as a character and the effect that he's had for, what is it now, 80 years almost? So I like that it's getting a little bit meta. I would expect nothing less from Tom King, but it's there's less of that in this Batman book than there have been on some of his other titles. Heroes in Crisis, which is coming out right now, Mr. Miracle, which just ended, Vision is another one, Grayson even to some extent, where he's kind of made a commentary on comics and heroes and how we as a society relate to them, how we treat our heroes, all that kind of stuff. There's always some subtext into the stories that Tom King is telling, which is part of what makes them so good. I feel like in a way there's less subtext about us when it comes to Batman, and more it's more just about the character of Batman himself. And maybe it's just that I don't relate that much to Batman, that I don't necessarily feel like it's that much about me. I'm certainly not a billionaire. I certainly don't put on a cape and cowl and go out and hunt criminals at night. So maybe that's just me. Maybe you have a lot of money and you're out there fighting crime and you relate to Batman a lot more than me. But either way, it's incredible storytelling. And really great art by Mikhail Yanin, as I always come to expect from Mikhail. All right, last book I want to mention, it's part 2 of Unspoken Water, Aquaman 44 by writer Kelly Sue DeConnick, pencils by Robson Roca, inks by Daniel Enriquez and colors by Sonny Go with letters by Clayton Cowles. We actually get to see a little bit of Mira in this issue, and I have to say that Robson Rocha draws her exquisitely, and it's nice to see him getting to depict Mira in her royal garb with lots of detail and intricate headdress and, you know, beautiful dress that she's wearing. It's really cool. I think Rocha is an artist that is incredibly talented. Great sense of storytelling, great detail, great line work. The other part of the story, the majority of the issue, is all about Aquaman and him trying to discover who he is and regain his memories. We also learn a lot about the other inhabitants of the island that he's on. And the first issue, I feel like, was paced a little slowly. This seems to be picking up a little bit, and I imagine the next issue, the pace will pick up even more. Kelly Sue is certainly pacing it deliberately, I believe, in order to kind of ratchet up the tension and the drama, and for me, it's working. The final page of this issue, where we get a close-up of Aquaman in a situation where he may be rediscovering who he is absolutely a great cliffhanger to end on. And it also made me very happy that this book comes out every other week, so I don't have to wait a whole month to find out what's going to happen next. The information and the identities of the other inhabitants on the island I found to be interesting and a great take. And how Aquaman, once he regains his memories, relates to them is going to be maybe the most fun I've had reading an Aquaman comic in a long time. So I love what Kelly Sue's doing. She mentioned at New York Comic Con that she didn't want to tell another one of those man of two worlds accepted by neither, fish out of water kind of stories. She wanted to do something completely different and really raise Aquaman to the next level. I think what James Tynan and Scott Snyder did with Aquaman in the Drowned Earth storyline set this story up perfectly, and I can't wait to see if Kelly Sue brings Arthur back, brings Aquaman back to the point where he was at in the Drowned Earth storyline that made me see Aquaman in a new light for the first time, and that maybe was my favorite Aquaman depiction, my favorite way I've ever seen the character, and that was as a symbol of hope. It was so unexpected in a way. I mean, I never would have thought about Aquaman as a symbol of hope before that Drowned Earth storyline, before I read it, but you could kind of see it building toward that. And certainly now with hindsight of 2020, you can go back and look at it and go, oh yeah, I can see the threads that Snyder and Tynan were creating. So I maybe because of that story, I'm reading into this story of where I can see, oh, he's going to end up as that symbol of hope for these people as well that he's trapped on the island with. But it could not be. It could completely go a different direction. And it's just that I'm kind of projecting my favorite part of the Drowned Earth storyline onto Kelly Sue's story. So trying not to do that, trying to just take it for what it is. But what it is a compelling story with really great art. And I had a feeling I would like Kelly Sue on Aquaman. I think it was a perfect choice for her to come over to DC to work on this character for the first time as her DC work. And I hope she's having as much fun working on it as I am having reading it, because it's really, really good, and I can't wait for the next issue. All right, let me give some of the other books that are out today that you may be interested in, other than the ones that I've already talked about. We have American Carnage number 3 from Brian Edward Hill, coming out from Vertigo. That's out today. From Brian Michael Bendis, we have Cover number 5 of 6, which has been a pretty fun title. We also have, over on the Sandman side of things, Lucifer number 4, Pearl number 6, also from Brian Michael Bendis. I think that's the final issue of that series. Meanwhile, over at IDW, we have My Little Pony Friendship is Magic number 74. We have G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, The Silent Option, the penultimate issue, issue number 3 of 4, and that's starring the new Snake Eyes. That's coming out today as well. I think I said tomorrow earlier. That's because I'm recording this on Tuesday. But yeah, all the books I'm talking about today come out today, or talking about on this episode come out today as this is being released Wednesday, January 23rd. Kind of a light week for Image this week. The only issues I'll mention is Die, 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 number 7. I already talked about Hardcore, number 2. And then I'll also mention that there's an Oliver, number 1 issue coming out today with a couple of really cool covers, one by Derek Robertson, one by Glenn Fabry. And it's a futuristic twist on the classic Oliver tale from Charles Dickens. So that might be one that's really fun. I may have to check that one out. Over at Marvel, because they always have to have some number ones coming out, we've got Crypt of Shadows number 1, which I believe is kind of a throwback to some of the old horror titles that Marvel put out even before they were Marvel. We also have Guardians of the Galaxy number 1 from Donny Cates. There is also a new issue of Immortal Hulk number 12. Really looking forward to that. Man Without Fear number 4 from Chip Zdarsky. And another kind of a throwback to some old Marvel titles from before they were Marvel. We have War is Hell number 1. And I know that cover A of War is Hell is by Dan Panosian and is a really, really cool looking cover. And I think that one's written by Howard Chaykin, but I think there's some reprinted material in there as well. And then the last thing I'll mention is from Valiant. We have a Live Wire issue number 2, which will be covering on an upcoming Valiant Sunday from Vita Ayala, which issue 1 was spectacular. So I expect nothing less from issue 2. So that's going to do it for this episode. Thanks for joining us as always. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. All past episodes of the podcast are available on all 3 platforms, as well as LRM Online. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage for your favorite upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All 3 spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank you all for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.